This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You know, this was initially pioneered by the Wagner Group as a way of gaining influence and trying to shape the narratives, trying to soften support for the military coups that we saw, and then subsequently supporting the juntas that seized control.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, on a new study that shows Russia is the main source of disinformation campaign in Africa. Details coming up. Also, Bassirou Diomaye Faye won Senegal's presidential election with 54.2% of the votes. And a slow-moving cyclone that turned towards Madagascar has killed at least 11 people. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A recent study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies shows that Russia continues to be the primary purveyor of disinformation in Africa, sponsoring 80 documented campaigns targeting more than 22 countries. The study indicated a strong link between the scope of disinformation and instability on the African continent. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Center for Strategic Studies, discussed the study's findings with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
What we see is that African countries that are in conflict are exposed on average to 5 distinct disinformation campaigns. And this is considerably more than what we see in other countries. And there are a number of reasons for that. Countries in conflict are often zones of competition for foreign influence. So in the Sahel, in Libya, in the Central African Republic. But we also see, you know, conflict being an amplifier and an incentive for disinformation by domestic actors who want to control the narrative. And we saw this in Ethiopia. We're seeing this in Sudan. And we're also seeing a consistent pattern of domestic actors in a conflict situation using disinformation to try to undermine UN peace operations. This is what we saw in Mali, see this in the Central African Republic. And we're seeing it in the DRC. And this is a means to try to isolate, marginalize the UN, try to use them as a scapegoat. But it also removes the UN from the accountability role that they have played in these societies. And so it gives usually the government actors who are behind the disinformation more influence and more room to undertake their often repressive actions, actions involving human rights violations against their own populations that they don't want the UN to talk about.
What are the striking examples of African countries confronting disinformation campaigns?
As awareness of foreign-backed disinformation on the continent has grown in the last couple of years, we are seeing a belated effort on the part of African fact-checkers, journalists, and researchers to work together to raise their capacity and awareness about disinformation and identify both the skills and the tactics that those using disinformation are using so that this can be better exposed and it can be better reported upon to raise awareness of the problem. In our report, you know, we cite more than 30 African groups who have been part of these research efforts. And so there is growing effort to push back and for African groups and individuals to reclaim this information space and restore authentic dialogue and debate within their countries.
According to the study, Russia continues to be the primary purveyor of disinformation in Africa, sponsoring 80 documented campaigns targeting more than 22 countries. How did Russia do that and why?
Russia is by far the most prolific promoter of disinformation, and they're doing so across the continent with a heavy concentration in West Africa, where they have 35 campaigns. So it's half of all the disinformation campaigns in West Africa are linked to Russia. You know, this was initially pioneered by the Wagner Group as a way of gaining influence and trying to shape the narratives, trying to soften support for the military coups that we saw, and then subsequently supporting the juntas that seized control. It involves a combination of Russian-backed information communication outlets, as well as state media, as well as the alignment with different African influencers that collectively provide a barrage of disinformation that overwhelms a particular information space and tends to create an echo chamber that makes these positions seem widely held and popular. And so in that way, they've been very effective in shaping the information environment in a number of these countries, especially in West Africa, and in the process, creating more influence for both the juntas and for Russia in the region.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. A anti-establishment figure, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, has won the Senegalese presidential election with 54.28% of votes. The French news agency AFP reports official provisional results show the governing coalition's candidate, former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, was a distant second with 35.79%. The victory for Faye, who was freed from prison 10 days before the Sunday's election, still has to be validated by Senegal's top constitutional body, which could happen in a few days. Faye, 44, who has said he wants a break with the current political system, is set to become the youngest president in Senegal's history. It would be the first time since independence from France in 1960 that an opponent has won in the first round. As the conflict between Sudan's army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, approaches the one-year mark, the country's women continue to bear the brunt of unimaginable hardships and severe human rights violations. Reporter Angie Omar has this report.
When Sudan's pro-democracy movement led to the removal of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir in 2019, women played a leading role in the revolution for democracy and change. Women have long faced marginalization, harassment, and sexual violence in Sudan, and they made up a significant portion of the protesters. Today, they suffer the brunt of the civil war that began in mid-April last year. More than 6 million people, including some 105,000 pregnant women, have been forced to leave their homes since the war began, according to the United Nations. Out of the 1.2 million people who fled to neighboring countries, almost 90% are women and children. A Khartoum woman, we are referring to her by first name, Hana, for safety reasons, says her life was upended when the conflict reached her neighborhood. She tells VOA she was forced to leave her home. Bodies were laying on the street, and the stench. Some of the bodies were covered by cardboard, and others were not. I put my son's head down so he doesn't see these scenes, but he could hear his siblings screaming. Women, children, and men were running in different directions. I was just staying with my children. Even my oldest daughter was running and screaming, "Mom, Mom!" Reports from the United Nations have documented violations against women in Darfur, including murder, forced displacement, and rape. Some of the victims were children. The violence is reminiscent of the devastation that occurred in the region two decades ago, when more than 200,000 people were killed. The repeated detention of women on false espionage charges or because of their ethnicity has been a serious concern raised by volunteers and human rights organizations. The impact of the conflict on Sudan's education sector has also been devastating, especially for female students. Many girls are at risk of being forced into child marriages or becoming displaced. According to UNICEF, 49% of girls are missing out on primary education. As of 2017, well before the current conflict began, 3 million children have been left out of Sudan's education system. Half of them are girls. Sudan's legal system follows a strict form of Sharia law, which limits the rights of women. Sharia has seeped into Sudanese culture, thus affecting the quality and quantity of girls' education. Huda Shafiq, a feminist peace activist, says the Islamist rule in Sudan has deprived women and girls of their basic human rights.
A big part of their program were heavily targeting women in a way that they have founded and changed a lot of laws, for example, that aimed mainly to control women, to really control their working, their access to work opportunities, their access to education opportunities, their existence in the public spaces, in the outside areas, in their engagement in the public life, but also socially and in the workplaces as well.
Displaced women face many challenges, including the loss of their homes, belongings, and personal security. Many have been separated from their families and have been unable to reunite due to the chaos of war. Ihsan Fagiri is a human rights activist and chair of the initiative No to Oppression Against Women in Sudan. She urges awareness be spread across the country about women's rights.
If we spread awareness among women, we need to change all the laws made by Muslim Brothers or al-Bashir regime. We need completely to eradicate those and to have another laws which are very consistent with the laws of the international agreements.
The war has severely restricted the freedom of women living with conservative extended families. Strict patriarchal structures and cultural norms limit their movement and how they dress, forcing displaced women to conform and give up their independence. Despite their immense challenges, Sudanese women have shown remarkable resilience. They continue to fight for their rights, advocate for peace, and support their communities. Women continue to protect their children and strive to rebuild their lives. For VOA News, I'm Inja Omar in Cairo, Egypt.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A slow-moving cyclone that turned towards Madagascar has killed 11 people as high winds ripped down trees and torrents of water rushed through villages, washing away houses. The National Disaster Management Office says Cyclone Gamani was projected to just skim the Indian Ocean island, but changed course and made landfall in the north yesterday. The French news agency AFP reports that some 7,000 people were affected by the storm. The cyclone moved slowly, amplifying its destructive effects, including the flooding of numerous routes and bridges. A non-profit environmental group says cocoa costs three times more than it did a year ago, a result of climate change and El Nino weather effect. The world's largest cocoa exporters, Ivory Coast and Ghana, have experienced extreme weather conditions that have exacerbated the situation. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
With a week until Easter, chocolate lovers should brace themselves for higher prices when they head to stores to purchase their favorite seasonal treats. Prices reached $8,000 per ton this week, compared to $2,500 last year at this time. Amber Sawyer is a climate and energy analyst at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, or ECIU, a UK-based non-profit environmental group. She says the volatile weather pattern in the cocoa-producing countries of Ghana and Ivory Coast has affected international commodity prices.
Chocolate producers are trying to buy up cocoa, but there's a reduced supply of it. So obviously, because of the reduced supply, the demand has gone up and the prices have therefore gone up for confectionery companies who make chocolate. And these costs are now feeding through to consumers as well. So here in the UK, companies like Mondelez, who own very quintessentially British brands like Cadbury's, have said that they're going to have to put some of their prices up to cover these increased input costs. And some other companies have also said that they're going to be reducing the size of their products for the same price.
The ECIU says cocoa prices have more than tripled in the past 12 months. Ghana and Ivory Coast were among the African countries that experienced heavy rains in December 2023. Those rains caused flooding, crop damage, and cocoa plants to rot with black pod disease. The two West African nations produce nearly 60% of the global cocoa. Sawyer says unfavorable weather patterns have affected harvests.
The two countries have been experiencing extreme heat. So obviously that's affecting not only the crop, because it's difficult to grow cocoa in these conditions, but also the farmers themselves. So that's the sort of temperature element of extreme heat that's happening in West Africa. But also there's been extremes in rainfall as well. So before Christmas, there was too much rain and lots of cocoa plants were rotting in the fields with black pod disease, which is a type of rot. And then after Christmas, there's been droughts as well. So farmers have gone from having too much rain to not enough rain, which means that they're behind on production and are unable to sell on the international markets.
Ghana has reduced its cocoa production estimate this year from 850,000 to 650,000 tons due to adverse weather conditions and smuggling. United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization data show cocoa is grown in countries that are most vulnerable and less prepared to deal with climate change. The UK-based World Weather Attribution website analysis released Thursday shows that West Africa experienced an intense heatwave in February, with temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius. Izzedine Pinto is a researcher with the Royal Netherlands Meteorological Institute connected to the website. He says the heat waves and heavy rainfall are affecting people's lives and sources of income.
Climate change is making rainfall heavier and also heat waves like these more intense. And these changes to extreme weather are making life more dangerous for people in West Africa and also in the Africa. And this is damaging is damaging livelihoods, for example, damaging crops, and then making food prices more expensive because of changes in variability of the climate and climate change.
Weather experts note that heat waves used to occur once every 100 years before widespread fossil fuel burning. But in today's climate, heat waves happen once every 10 years. African countries bear the brunt of climate change despite contributing the least to greenhouse gas emissions. The ECIU urges wealthier nations, such as Britain, to offer financial and technical aid to assist farmers in managing the impact of severe weather and climate change. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Since the end of last month, more than a dozen countries in the WHO Africa region have documented probable or confirmed cases of yellow fever. Dr. William Komkech, WHO epidemiologist for infectious disease control in the Democratic Republic of Congo, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme the overall number of confirmed cases is down from a year ago, but active surveillance is required due to the potential for transmission through travel and the presence of the mosquito vector in neighboring regions.
How many cases you have of yellow fever in Africa, the whole continent, and, you know, maybe break down where you're most concerned about outbreaks of yellow fever in certain countries?
Usually every year we provide information on the number of cases every year. This usually comes through the weekly WHO's weekly epidemiological record. But the report is released in the month of August. Those countries were Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, Congo, Cote d'Ivoire, DRC, Guinea, Niger, Nigeria, South Sudan, Uganda.
A lot of those countries that you just mentioned have conflict. If not a civil war, they have insurgencies going on and other things like that. Does that contribute to higher cases of yellow fever?
In a way, it could, in the sense that it could delay effective response. You know, we have seen that, for example, with the Central African Republic, where you find that the response vaccination campaigns tend to be delayed because sometimes of reasons related to, you know, security challenges. Transportation, for example, would be difficult. Supervision and, you know, deployment of the vaccines.
Is the number of fatal cases, would you say, down overall than it was a year ago?
Yes. In 2023, we didn't have, big disruptive outbreaks, which usually lead to a number of fatalities. There's been some reduction from 2020-21, where we had 18% fatality, to now estimated at about 11% for 2023. But you have to remember that yellow fever itself actually is a severe illness, which is often fatal.
What is the cause, usually of the proliferation of yellow fever?
Well, yellow fever is transmitted by a mosquito vector. So let's say after the rainy season or in the midst of the rainy season, when the mosquito population proliferates, you tend to get increases in the number of cases. The disease is mainly a disease of the wild animals, the monkeys, the the baboons. So situations that increase, contacts between humans and the animals in the wild, maybe, expansion in settlements, activities like artisanal mining, lumber, opening new roads, hunting, for example, could also lead to, cases of yellow fever. Because it will increase contacts between the vectors in the wild, which probably could be infected, and then the humans that are not, particularly those not protected by vaccination.
What does the WHO do to fight the proliferation of yellow fever or try to eradicate it?
It's probably not possible at the moment to eradicate yellow fever because it's a disease that circulates in the wild. So what WHO does is to support member states where there is a risk of transmission to prevent outbreaks occurring through, number one, protecting the population that are at risk through vaccination. And then secondly, to try and prevent international spread, again, also through vaccinating and making sure that travelers from countries that are at risk or those going to countries that are at risk of yellow fever are vaccinated against yellow fever. And then thirdly, to make sure that in the event of an outbreak, the response is fast.
That was Dr. William Komakeche, WHO epidemiologist for infectious disease control. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Brazzaville in the DRC. Mali's ruling military junta says it has ended a national reconciliation accord with northern separatists. The government has also agreed to strengthen cooperation with Russia to fight terrorism in the country. The 2015 Algiers Accords ended 3 years of war in Mali between government forces and various separatist groups in the north, including Tuareg and Arab nationalists. A government statement yesterday said Prime Minister Choguel Koalala Mai has informed the Council of Ministers of the repeal of the decrees to the institutions put in place to apply the agreement. It says the repeal follows the government's decision to end the accord with immediate effect. Also, the French news agency AFP reports that the Kremlin announced yesterday that Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke by phone to the head of the junta, Colonel Assimi Goïta, and the president of Congo Brazzaville, Denis Sassou Nguesso. The Kremlin says Putin and Goïta agreed to strengthen anti-terrorist cooperation and discussed strengthening cooperation in energy, agriculture, and mining projects.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
Your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And as we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight, we would like to wish our colleague, Sunny Young, host of the popular Sunny Side of Sports show, the best in his retirement from the Voice of America. And as usual, thanks for listening to the Voice of America.